Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Roleplay Chat. I'm Matt, a game master who can't stop talking about role-playing games. Today on Roleplay Chat, we're going to be exploring storytelling in your tabletop RPG play, and I'm extremely excited to be talking to somebody who does this professionally, writing stories. So it's going to be a really, really cool conversation. I hope you look forward to it. As usual, at the 30-minute mark, there's going to be our indie spotlight, and this week we're talking about A Tome of Twins by Cats Have No Lords, so stay tuned for that about at the 30-minute mark. But before we get ahead of ourselves, let's jump right in to today's conversation. So today we are joined by a gamer, storyteller, and author with over a dozen fantasy novels published out there for you to read, several of those being within the context, within the worlds of the Dungeons & Dragons universe. You may know her for her New York Times best-selling debut novel, Mark of the Dragonfly, Please, or perhaps her most recent book, The Fallbacks, Bound for Ruin. Please welcome me in welcoming Jaylee Johnson to Roleplay Chat. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm really excited to be talking to you today. Storytelling is, I think, critical to all role-playing games, and I'm also excited to kind of pick your brain to learn a little bit more about what went on behind the curtains as you were writing The Fallbacks, Bound for Ruin. So I'm kind of melding those two worlds together, if you would. Yeah. So maybe before we dive too deep into all of this, why don't you let us know a little bit about your kind of geek origin story, if you would. You know, what kind of games do you like to play? What kind of books do you like to read and write? And give us a brief introduction of who you are in this geek space, and then we can kind of dig deeper.
So my geek origin story starts when I am 5 years old. I have an older brother who is 11 years older than I am. I was the last minute surprise in my family. And so when I was 5 years old, he was 16, and he was deeply into playing Dungeons and Dragons with his friends in our parents' garage. And so I have these vivid memories of being 5 years old and sitting in the garage on a lawn chair, listening to my brother and his friends spin these amazing stories about adventurers going on quests and fighting monsters, collecting treasure. And I was hooked from 5 years old. That sounded like the best kind of make-believe to me. And so it just got worse from there as I got older. I got into fantasy novels, and I fell in love with The Lord of the Rings and the Dragonlance Chronicles and Spellfire, and just that was it for me. And somewhere along the way, I turned that love of fantasy novels, of reading fantasy novels, into wanting to create fantasy worlds of my own and to create characters that people could care about in the way that I just fell in love with these characters. Mm-hmm. You know? And just, I wanted, to me as a kid, that seemed like a superpower, and I wanted that superpower very badly. So that's where it all started for me.
Awesome. Well, I definitely think that you've, at the very least, brushed up against that superpower if you don't already have it, because your characters in the books that I've gotten the opportunity to look through, they're there. The characters are really, really compelling. And I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about that maybe today. But perhaps with that introduction, why don't you introduce us and talk to us very briefly about your most recent book, The Fallbacks, Bound for Ruin?
So The Fallbacks, they're a brand new adventuring party who've been put together by this ambitious rogue, Tessalind, or Tess, and she wants to be the best. She wants to have the best adventuring party in Faerun, and she goes about assembling this group of very different individuals, and unexpectedly sees how much secrets and how much baggage of their own they have, and having to get all these very different individuals to work together and also to survive their first job together, because they immediately get in over their heads encountering this magical sentient tome called the Ruinous Child, that basically hates them, wants them to fail at life and just to die, and they have to figure out how to deal with this terrible malevolent magical item.
Yeah. Sounds kind of like most adventuring parties, it feels like, you know, just a hodgepodge group of people.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. And I love that, because that is exactly the lived experience of most Dungeons & Dragons parties, I feel. You know, a group of people picking these sometimes outlandish characters, slapping them together and you know, hoping the glue holds as they face off against whatever things that they end up fighting up against. So I love how much it feels like a real D&D party. You know, that's really great. As far as your inspiration for this party or the stories within the book, I imagine that tabletop role-playing games had a part in that. Could you talk to me a little bit about what elements of the story and the book were inspired by actual play, actual dice being rolled, maybe adventures you went on with people, you know, in your gaming group, whether that be online or in person or whatnot? How did those two worlds interconnect?
It wasn't so much that there was any direct experiences that I've played in that came, you know, whole cloth over to the book. It was more that idea of this desire to take, like, you know, the core character classes, you know, mm-hmm. We got, you know, you got have the fighter, you got the rogue, you got the wizard, you've got your core classes, and kind of using that as an entry point for people, you know, that might be new to the game, you know, new to introduction to the Forgotten Realms, to D&D, to what have you, and just giving that to them through these core classes that are like the essence of D&D, but also at the same time taking these core classes and putting, you know, just a little twist on each one of them, mm-hmm. and doing something a little bit different, you know, whether it's Baldrick's character and his unique relationship with the gods, you know, or kind of bringing Tess as a rogue into a leadership role within the party, rather than have her being like kind of the shadowy figure, the lone wolf character, just taking the core elements that we know and love from D&D and just putting a little bit of a twist on each of them. So that was the approach.
Yeah. Because most people, I would imagine, are pretty familiar with those archetypes, right? I the first time anybody plays a rogue, they're out there being moody and grumpy, and they run off on their own. Those even narrative archetypes, sometimes we'll see the character growth in a D&D game where the rogue will start off as being moody, lone wolf, but will learn to love and trust and all of that stuff. And that's the kind of stuff that people playing the game almost, you anticipate it, I guess, right, is what I'm trying to say. You put up with the lone wolf rogue because you know in five games they're going to come around and they're gonna protect you from the big baddie or what have you.
Mm-hmm. At least that's the hope, that they're going to protect you when it comes to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's great. And then, so as far as the narrative goes too, was all of that just your own creation, your own inspiration, or was there some inspiration from a game that maybe you were a part of, or a game that you game mastered, or an adventure that you went on?
No direct elements. I try not to pull direct experiences that. But I mean, there is that, you know, trying to evoke that feeling, if that makes sense, of, you know, sitting around the table with your friends, having this experience of, you know, playing this game. It's not so much that I try to replicate an encounter or a monster or something like that, but I am chasing that kind of feeling of, you know, that kind of universal experience that we have when we're sitting around the gaming table with our friends. And like you said, bringing these, you know, different hodgepodge characters together and seeing how they react with each other. I always am keeping that in mind of how, you know, my own players, you know, or how would my button pusher in the party react to this, you know, mm-hmm. this treasure chest sitting in the middle of the room and, you know, seemingly unguarded, you know, how would, because, you know, there's always that, you know, we have that kind of universal experience there to draw on with this game. So I'm kind
of, that's really cool.
Always looking for that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Did you tell your players that, like, oh, you button pusher, you would have done this, so I made my character do this in the book based off of your inspiration?
They know exactly who they know I got them.
That's awesome. That's great. And now, as far as storytelling goes, I'd be curious to know what you find to be the core elements of a story. What do you value the most in a story when you're trying to tell it? Whether that be, you know, whether that be in a book that you're writing, or in a tabletop role playing game when you're game mastering a game. What are the things that you think are critical for a good story?
The things that draw me in most, or that appeal to me most, are probably character and world building. World building, because, I mean, that goes all the way back to me being a kid and, you know, cracking open a fantasy novel and seeing the map in front of the book. I mean, and it was, and getting the sense that, oh, this is a fully fleshed out world that I can get lost in, and that I feel like is a living and breathing place that goes on whether I, you know, am inhabiting it or not, or whether I am reading this book or not. I felt that way about the Forgotten Realms for a long time. And so I think based on that, and based on how I would get lost in those fantasy worlds, world building is very important to me. And then character, because, as I said, when I was growing up and reading, you know, about the Heroes of the Lance, and these characters felt so real to me, and I just, you know, cared about them so much, what happened to them. These people that are fictional and never existed, but I just cared about them so deeply, and wanting to try to, you know, create characters of my own in that same way. So that's probably world building and characters are what draw me to these stories again and again.
Probably. Yeah, definitely. And as far as world building goes, when you're running a game with your table, are you running it in the Forgotten Realms, for instance, or is this like you have your own creation that's your own world, and you're using the Forgotten Realms in the context of, you know, the Fallbacks? But when you're playing your home game, are you also playing in Faerûn or in the Forgotten Realms, or are you playing in your own world?
In my home game, at least for right now, we're playing in Faerûn.
Okay.
That's mostly a reflection of, I ask my players, you know, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? And a lot of times they will pick the direction they want to go with their characters. Like in our most recent campaign, we're doing Descent into Avernus because my players said, we want to go to the Helm. So I said, okay, just remember that you asked for it.
Yeah, you can't come back and get mad at me.
Documented evidence that you asked for this, and so now we're going to do this. And they're having a blast. So, you know, it's, I follow where they lead me when they say they want to, but it's, yeah, we've been, at least for now, we've been in Faerûn. We've talked about maybe dipping our toes into some spell jamming. That's been on the table. We've talked about different things, but I like to see what they get excited about, what interests them, and then take me along for a ride.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, I suppose that they're the ones telling the story. We're just the arbiters of that story, but really they take it where they want to take it. It reminds me, I have a player at my table. I love him to death, but he always wants to make his characters more complicated. He always wants to make them have these moral dilemmas, and like self-imposes moral dilemmas on himself. In the most recent adventure, the most recent game session, he found a cursed crown artifact. And you should have seen his face. He got so lit up. He was like, a cursed crown. Like, I can't wait to put this on. And everybody else at the table was like, don't put the crown on. Please don't do it. Little does he know, I have no idea what the crown does. I have to go and figure that out. I actually used the hive mind the other day to be like, help me come up with a curse for this thing. But anyway,
emotional damage as possible.
That's it. He just wants to be, have his character be torn apart by these moral dilemmas, which makes for interesting character development. But
well, thank goodness he's got you there to take him up on that. And you're just gonna, you will provide.
That's it.
His DMs love to get tidbits like that because it's like, oh, you want to suffer?
Okay. Yeah, let me show you the way. That's it. Absolutely, absolutely. Cool. So I think now might be as good a time as any to allow the folks over at Cats Have No Lords to talk to us a little bit about their game, their module, rather. It's like an independently created adventure called A Tomb of Twins. So we're going to listen to, I believe it's Luke who's talking here. So we're going to listen to Luke talk a little bit about the adventure module, and then we're going to come right back over here to talk some more about storytelling with Jaylee.
Hi, Matt. This is Luke Simons, the creator of A Tomb of Twins, and I am so happy to be able to talk with you about this today. So A Tomb of Twins is a small dungeon intended to be run as kind of a one-shot or maybe a short 2-3 session run, depending on how you do it. It includes a village where you can come and find out about a strange tomb that is just outside the village where two ancient necromancers were buried after they'd been terrorizing the land for years before that point. And you can meet several NPCs and factions around there, all of whom want some mysterious relic from the center of the tomb. Now, the tomb itself is split essentially into two pathways, going from the entrance around and into the central burial chamber. And the pathways were originally mirrors of each other, but some goblin-like creatures known as the Swampkins have recently come into one half of it, meaning we actually get kind of some asymmetry of different types of challenges on the two paths, and you need to go on both of them to get some artifacts that help get you into the burial chamber, where you can try to get the relic that everyone wants and hopefully avoid getting attacked or killed by the liches who are buried in there. So what inspired me to make this was actually 2 years ago. Now, I was just getting into old school style dungeon crawling role playing. I was just getting into Twitter and the TTRPG space on Twitter. And it was Tuesday, February 2, 2022. And I was going to be running a one shot. And so I thought I would make something that was twin focused with these mirrored pathways and kind of playing off of that theme. And so I made it and I ran it with a group using the Black Hack and had a lot of fun with that. But then this was at this time when I was just getting onto Twitter and there was all this energy around making things and sharing things. And I was just learning about itch.io and all these ways that you could just put stuff out there. And there was an old school game jam happening in June of 2022. And so I just took what I had written to run for my own table, threw it into a very, very basic layout, and submitted it to this jam. And didn't think much about it until I saw sometime later that it had been reviewed on an old school dungeon review website, 10-foot pole, and had gotten a rather negative review, actually, which kind of opened my eyes both to the problems with how it had been written originally, and also just kind of inspired me to want to do better. And so A Tomb of Twins is a much improved version of what I originally put out 2 years ago. Kind of went back through trying to clean it up, tighten it up, give better descriptions, give better reasons for doing things in the rooms other than there's a trap here. What are you going to do about it? Trying to make things more interesting with the NPCs, the factions, the interactions you can have. And then tightening up the layout, working with an artist to get what I still think is just some amazing art that I was able to include in there. And then I had the chance to play test it in a bunch of other systems. I kind of used it as a vehicle for myself being able to try out lots of different old school systems, which is how it ended up actually having stats now for three different systems for the monsters at the end of it. But in general, it's intended to be more of a system neutral thing that you can pick up and run in different things without too much trouble. And so why I would recommend people check it out. If you are interested in learning more about the old school style, if you're interested in something where the problems don't really have set solutions, where you're going in and you're not really looking for a big fight. In fact, if you can avoid the fights in this dungeon to just get to the burial chamber, the better. There are ways around everything that if you're paying attention, if you're working slowly and carefully, if you're thinking critically, thinking about problem solving instead of just bashing in and fighting, you'll do a lot better and have a lot more fun in this situation. And I think it's a great dungeon from my own experience running. It's a great dungeon for figuring out that type of play and learning how to enjoy something that might be different than what a lot of people are used to, where the combat encounters are not balanced, where there are no preset solutions to the problems, and where you can just kind of get in and explore and have some fun. Thanks.
Thanks for these details, Luke. And now for the review portion of the Indie Spotlight. Now, so as far as my opinion goes for the adventure of the Tomb of Twins, I have a few thoughts that I wanted to share. So first of all, I think this is an adventure that's fun, and it really kind of embodies the classic dungeon delve experience, you know, old school play, if you would. People looking for something to kind of slide into their existing campaign or adventure definitely have a good 3 to 5 hours of play here within the contents of the Tomb of Twins module or adventure book. I would say you might even have more, depending on how slowly your party moves through a dungeon or interacts with the setting elements that the book has at the beginning. But yeah, so as an overview, kind of like Luke mentioned already, the book is divided into three main parts. The first is a section that talks about the history, details out some NPCs and factions, and a little bit of a location, like a starting village, if you would, that surrounds the crypt. The second section of the module or the adventure book is the dungeon itself, which, you know, takes up probably, I'd say, about 80% of the contents of the book, with a dozen or so rooms that you can go through. And then the last section is a bunch of creature stat blocks. These stat blocks are separated out for three different systems: Crack, Morkborg, and Cairn systems. I'd say the best part of the module is without a doubt the tomb itself. The dual mirrored chambers of the tomb offer a really interesting take on, you know, a typical necromancer's tomb. There's also a lot of effort that Luke has put into creating each route as being distinct, with the inclusion of kind of little goblins, or I think they were called something else, but essentially little goblins. Each of the rooms has a lot of different conflicts, challenges for you and the party to interact with. And even if you don't take the adventure verbatim for what it is, there's a lot of different flavor and treasures and puzzles and traps that you can incorporate independently into your game if that's how you'd like to do it, or if you want to kind of modify the dungeon too. So there's a lot there for sure. I mean, for my taste, maybe too many traps, but you know, I don't often play kind of old school dungeons anyway. As far as some of the things in the module, you know, other things in the module that I liked a little bit less, for me personally, was I found that the first section, the section that kind of lays the land and gives us a little bit more setting details and that kind of stuff, I found that section a little bit harder to get through. I felt like it was quite short and tried to cover a lot of ground. You know, there's a lot of good information there, the NPCs, the factions. There's a lot of background there that's left up to your own interpretation. And I know, most of the time when you're looking at an adventure module like this, there's definitely a need for you to kind of make your own notes. And I think that that's definitely the case here in A Tome of Twins, especially if you plan on playing through that first part. But yeah, so going back to what I liked about the dungeon, like I said, it's really well laid out. There's even a mini, there's the big map at the beginning, and then there's mini maps presented throughout as you go on through the rooms to help you situate yourself as the arbiter of the game. And there's also details listed out with bolded kind of subheadings that repeat throughout each of the rooms so that you know where to look right away for the description of the trap or where to look right away for the treasures or the enemies that are there. Overall, I think A Tome of Twins is a really versatile adventure with the inclusion of stat blocks for three systems, Crack, Morkborg, and Cairn. And even if you're not running one of those systems, the descriptions and the enemies that you find here, I think, are common enough source material. You know, there's ghosts and goblinoids and a necromancer and that kind of stuff. So these kinds of creatures are relatively common in other source material, so you would very easily be able to find stat blocks for those creatures if you weren't running a Crack, Morkborg, or Cairn. And so yeah, so I think that this is a really awesome adventure. And like I said, if you're wanting to have a necromancer's tomb with a twist in your game, A Tome of Twins will scratch that itch with interesting challenges across all pillars of play. So go check it out. The link will be in the show notes for Cats Have No Lord, the Luke's publishing house, and you can buy it there. Thanks again, Luke, for sharing this with me. And we're back. So thank you for folks listening to that. And thanks to Luke for sending over a copy of his game. I hope everybody checks it out. The links for the game will be in the show notes for today's show. Jilly, and we're back here. We're talking about storytelling. We're talking about your new book, The Fallbacks Bound for Ruin. And when I was preparing my questions for you, somebody who's written quite a few books within the D&D settings and the D&D world, the first question that I wanted to ask you, the first question that came to mind was, what's it like writing a book within the existing D&D universe? Like, there's so much content that exists already. There's so much canonical elements of this world. How is it dealing with all of that? Is it a boon? Is it a challenge? What's it like writing a book with, all of the stuff that's already there that you kind of have to take for truth, I suppose.
Oh, it's definitely a challenge. I mean, it's not so much that it's not a scary proposition though, because I have loved the realms for so long. I have read so much and played so much that it still feels like home to me. But it is definitely a challenge to acknowledge and to, find your place in everything that's come before, and also, push and find something new to say within the setting and with the characters. And I mean, you have a lot of help. I mean, working within an established world like this, it's a very collaborative process, and there's people there to help you. And when you have questions like, oh, that's, there's a lot of creative help there, and you don't do it alone. You're not in the sandbox by yourself. But no, it's also just an honor and a privilege to be able to make a contribution to something like that that I have loved for so long. Because yeah, I've loved the realm since my brother brought home a copy of Spellfire, the novel, and he started reading it, and I swiped it from his room and finished it before he did because I couldn't wait. He said, "I'll give it to you when I'm done." I said, "Okay." And then I went and took it and read it anyway because I couldn't wait. And I just, so yeah, it's a challenge, but it's incredibly fun.
Cool. As far as like the resources that you had, or could you elaborate a little bit more on that process? Like, were some of the Wizards of the Coast game developers at your disposal? Is that how that worked? Like, how exactly were you supported, if you don't mind me asking?
We were supported by my editors at Random House, by editors at Wizards of the Coast, and
Cool.
designers, and it's very much a team effort, to make sure that you get it right and you stay true to the spirit of the world. And it's great too because these are creative people who love this stuff the same way I do, who care about it and love it, and that is like fuel to me too. It makes the process, just even that much more rewarding.
Yeah, that's really neat. That's really cool. So now maybe we'll shift hats a little bit and talk about being a game master telling stories. I know that, like I had mentioned a little before, we're really only here to facilitate the story of the people that are playing the game. But at the same time, we have a very unique position in that we kind of direct the flow of the story to a certain degree, especially in some contexts. Like some players prefer to be more kind of spectators and allow you more control, whereas sometimes a table will take more of that narrative control to themselves. But I guess what I'm trying to ask you here, Jaylee, is as far as telling stories as a game master goes, what kind of advice could you give to somebody listening today who wants to improve kind of the narrative elements of their game session, of their games, and of their campaigns?
I'd say the biggest thing, or at least the biggest thing that has helped me in the past, is to communicate with your players and be open with your players about what they want out of this game. Because you might be surprised, and you also might be surprised when you pose the question to them and they actually take the time to think about it, what they actually want out of the game. Because I have players who, like you said, they want to be kind of guided. I know in that scenario that I need to give them choices, but not overwhelm them with options. And I get to that point by talking to them and also by playing in sessions with them and watching how they react to how I present the narrative. That's another big thing, is that I look for feedback in real time based on how they react to whatever I throw at them. And that has not only helped me as a game master, but it has helped me as a writer. Because, and I that's why I would say anyone who wants to DM a game, try writing a story. Anyone who wants to write a story, try DMing a game, because so many of the elements there can overlap. And when I am running a tense combat encounter with my players and I see them getting excited and more invested, and then I see that tipping point when they start to get stressed and they start to get, just a little bit jumpy, and I know that I need to, once this encounter's over, I need to get them to the tavern. I need to get them to someplace, that they can release that stress. I can't keep that tension going. Just like in a story, you have action, and you build your tension, but you also have to give the reader time to breathe and time to, recover. And you kind of can watch those beats of the story play out by watching your players' faces. And you can also see when they're getting bored by when they grab their phones and, are texting, or, grabbing for their, looking at the internet. You can tell when I need to, to throw some action at them. So just my advice would be open communication with your players. And not only asking for feedback, but looking for it, because they'll tell you things they don't expect to tell you when you're just watching them. And also, one more thing I would add to that is that for DMs that want to improve their narratives, you're probably doing a better job than you think you are. Go easy on yourself too.
It's really kind of you. Yeah. And I really like how you said, like, just watch your players, because open communication, 100%, always have it. Try to always talk to your players about everything. not just storytelling, the narrative elements. But sometimes a player will have a really hard time, in my experience, elaborating on what it is they want. They don't really know what they want. They might know sort of, right? Like they might know a feeling like, oh, I want to be scared, or oh, I want to feel heroic. But they sometimes they'll say they want something and they don't. They don't want that.
And what they react to ends up being completely different. But if you're watching and you wait for that moment and you can say, oh, yeah. And you can make your little note and say, oh, I need more of this. You know?
Exactly. When they start asking you questions, when they start rolling history checks on something, when they haven't cared about the history of anything for the past 10 games, and now they really want to know about, I don't know, the lore of the zombie owlbear, now you know you've got them. You know what I mean? Like that, just by the way that they interact with the game. You can definitely use that to your advantage. So I love that you said that, because 100%, I think that that's a really big one. As far as like traditional storytelling techniques go, or even just like writing strategies for writing a story, is there anything that a game master can learn from that, as far as the way that they should structure perhaps the narrative components of the like arc that they're trying to get through in their games? Is that something that you feel like there's enough parallel there, or is that like shoehorning it a little bit?
Well, I think there's definitely something to be learned there. Specifically, in my own experience, I've learned a lot about pacing that way. Just because, again, and just watching the players and watching how they react when they get bored, when they get excited, and knowing how, but the finer point there is knowing how long to make all of that stuff last, you know, because you can't, even though they may get excited and happy to combat and carry, you can't just keep hitting them with that over and over and over again, because then it starts to lose meaning. And I carry that into my narratives for novels too, because you have to learn how to break it up. And I remember reading an article, and I'm going to not remember the author's name, so I'm not going to be able to give proper credit. It might have been Scott Westerfeld. But anyway, it was the idea of when you finish a draft of your novel or your story, to go through your scenes and kind of look at, you know, kind of try to categorize your scene. Is this an action scene? Is this a downtime scene? Is this something where like intrigue or secrets are getting revealed? And just very broad categories, you know, and only like three or four categories. But go through and label each chapter, you know, or put them on note cards or something, or do something in your writing software, whatever you use, and then look at them and look at where, if you have, you know, five action chapters lined up in a row and then just like one downtime, it's amazing how when you lay it out like that, how you can see the structure of the story better. And it's led me to buying these whiteboards where I break down each of the chapters in my book, and you know, put the point of view character, and I put, you know, just a very brief summary of what happens. And, you know, is this action? Is this rest? Is this, you know, secrets? And then I can go through and look at the whole thing in the way that I can't when it's just on paper in front of it. And so,
super cool.
Yeah, that helps me, and that is something that, like I said, I've learned from other writers, and I've also learned from kind of, you know, doing it intuitively in the game by watching my players' reactions. So just, you know, different tools like that, whatever helps you, you know, tell the balanced story. I'll try anything once.
Yeah. No, I love that. I'm gonna start doing that when I prepare my games. I think that's really neat, because like you said, the pacing is so critical, right? You don't want to flub them with too much of the same thing. And sometimes you think it's going to be one thing and it's something else, because the players kind of interpret it a different way, or they really lean into the social element when you were expecting them to fight. But outside of that, usually you can guess, like, okay, we're going to start off the night with some kind of action sequence, and then we're going to slowly like ease into downtime, and then go into some kind of more social piece of the game. And having those categories highlighted ahead of time might enable, I know it'll enable me as a game master to be better equipped to describe it in certain ways and kind of like lean into that kind of play, or at least anticipate it. But that kind of leads me to wonder, Jaylee, when we're talking about a role-playing game, there's so many variables that we don't control, notably the players who will always find a way to surpass and surprise, me as far as the expectations go for what's going to happen in a night. And I'd love to know how you find that interactive and collaborative part of role-playing games. How does that kind of affect the way a story is told?
When I'm at the editing stage of a book, just as an example of this, and this could be when I have given it to a beta reader or an editor, or something, early stage development, essentially, and I get feedback from them. And that in itself is kind of a collaborative process. They're not involved at the in the writing of the book, but I have people who are my first readers, my first reactions to the stories that I write. And oftentimes that through that collaborative process, they will see my story in a completely different way than I might have intended. And that is incredibly valuable for me because it lets me know that, oh, I need to go back and do this because I definitely didn't want you to get the idea that these two characters were romantically attached. That's not what's happening here, so I need to fix that. But I did want you to sympathize with this character, and I'm glad that you did. And that kind of collaboration and interaction can help me see how people see the story. And relating that to the tabletop games, and I think you touched on this briefly when you're saying sometimes your players will interpret something completely differently than what you might have presented, or they'll take it in a direction that you didn't intend. And it helped me to analyze later, why did they get that impression? What did I do that led them to think that, this was, and that's a fascinating way to where both in the game and in writing a novel, you can get that feedback and that collaboration. It's also a good reminder to me that no matter how much I think I have conveyed a certain point, I may not have, And that's why you're always going to need editors, you're going to need people to give you that feedback. And so, yeah, I think that they're more similar. There's more of a collaborative element there than you might think, or you might initially think, because even though I am, alone in my computer writing this story, and it's different from what's happening at the gaming table, even though it's D&D, there's still similarities. There's still things that can be. It's not just me playing the parts. It's me trying to convey, to someone else, this is what I want you to see. And that's always the challenge, right? This is what I want you to see. Let's see how that's going to land. If that makes sense.
That does make a lot of sense. And if I can summarize my understanding of what you just said to make sure that I've understood it, is it that when you've written out a book or your first draft, the interpretation of the person reading it, whether that be your editor or your beta reader, their interpretation of the book is kind of akin to a player's interpretation of like your description of a scene or or you laying out the description of the next room in the dungeon and their interpretation there, it's kind of the same as somebody reading the book and then interpreting it for themselves. Is that kind of what I'm
Yeah,
did I get that?
you did. Exactly. You
Okay.
said it better than I could. But that's the thing is you can set that up for people. And this can go for like after, the book is published and this is, when it's not in my hands anymore, it's always going to be filtered through people's perceptions and they're going to make it their own, just the same way a player is going to make the game their own, because this is the story about them and their heroic deeds or their emotional damage, depending on your player and what they want. They're going to make the story their own. And that's also fascinating and bittersweet sometimes is seeing how they do that. And I think it's one of the reasons I both love to write and I both love to DM is I love to see where they take it, even if it's not what I intended.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's I think that echoes with me as well. You know, seeing where the players take it is always such a joy. I love it too when somebody who maybe hasn't been too involved in the narrative of their own character, or you know, they're just here to beat some goblins and get some treasure. But then every now and then they'll have a moment where they just, you know, a couple of game sessions ago, my wife plays at my gaming table, and I think her fun in role-playing games is pushing my buttons as we play the game to see how I can react, how well she can get me to like lose my cool, or anyway, that's her fun most of the time, and we joke about it between the two of us. I'm like, oh, what are you gonna do this time to get me all like riled up? But the other night, they were just about the party was just about to send secrets that they had discovered to an NPC that they have allied themselves with, and she comes to me and she goes, I want to tell you something in secret. And I'm like, oh, okay, you haven't wanted to do this ever before, let's hear it. And she brings me off to the side. Hopefully nobody's listening to this, because if it if a person in my home game is listening to this, skip ahead by like 2 minutes, because I don't want this spoiled for you.
No,
But
players, you know what to do.
yeah, skip the spoiler warning. She basically said that she wanted to also send a carbon copy of this letter to her grandmother, who was a new NPC that didn't exist before that moment. You know, she had never talked to me about her backstory before. She's like, I want to send a carbon copy of all of our secrets to my grandmother, who's going to be living in this, you know, little hut in the forest somewhere. And
Sure.
I'm like, oh, this is gold. Like, this is great. Now we have a whole new dimension to all of this.
You thought this through.
Yeah, she
This is
really
exactly what
thought,
she wanted.
that's it. That's it. So seeing this unexpected side of a character can make the story explode into all kinds of amazing new directions. And I kind of forgot where I was going with this, but I think that was kind of the point I was trying to make, is that yeah, the players can really add this new dimension by bringing in their own perception of the narrative. And sometimes it's like in this case, I couldn't have done it without it. You know, I couldn't have done it without her making that decision, making wanting to bring that forward.
Sometimes your players will unlock things for you that you didn't expect. And I have had that in writing. I have had that happen with critique partners and beta readers who I trust to read the story. They'll say, you know, I think this character actually wants this, or I think this is their character arc. And I'll be like, oh my goodness, you are right. That is exactly, and I never saw it before, but you saw it. And now I see it. And yeah, it's that just amazing alchemy that can happen. And yeah,
That's really cool. Has feedback like that ever made a significant change on the overall story? Like, have you like, oh, I gotta rewrite 5 chapters now because of this new thing? Has something like that ever happened?
it's usually a moment where I realize that I'm writing something about a character that I didn't realize I was writing, and someone else will see that simply because I'm too close to the character and I've been over the story too many times, and it takes that outside perspective to bring that in. I don't know if it's ever been a 5 chapter rewrite, but I've added arcs, I've added chapters, I've added things based on feedback from trusted readers because they saw something, and afterwards I'll be like, why didn't I see that? And but yeah, sometimes it just takes having that help, and the
Yeah,
people you
yeah.
trust or the players you trust,
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, like you said, right? When your nose is that close to it, sometimes you kind of get, I mean, I know in game mastering, sometimes I'll get tunnel vision. I could only imagine it'd be the same. You know, the blinders go up, you're telling the story, and sometimes little things fall off to the wayside. So having that extra feedback is critical.
It's great.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. I have one last question for you, Jaylee, and you touched on it a little bit. So if you don't have anything else to add, feel free to say so. But as far as tools go, you talked a little bit about this, you know, using the whiteboard to categorize chapters with these tags, for kind of the whether they're action scenes or whatnot. Are there other tools that you've used and then, or that you have in your repertoire when you're writing out a story that you think would be valuable to share with other people listening who want to write their own stories, whether that be for role-playing games or, you know, for their own, for a novel or something that they maybe they have cooking up?
Sure. Yeah, I mean the whiteboard is definitely a big one. Or I mean, if you don't have a whiteboard, just some note cards. I've gone that route before where I've just had, you know, a bunch of note cards spread out over my office floor, whether I wanted to see, you know, how many different points of view I have, and is that balanced? Is the action balanced? Is everything anything that you want to see a pattern or see or look for patterns? That's a good way to do it. I am also, what helps me, I'm a big outliner. So I will do not just like an overall synopsis or outline of a project. When I'm doing it, I'll break down and do a chapter by chapter outline. And typically I do that by hand instead of typing because it slows me down enough to where I can really kind of stop and think about the action, the character development, the different arcs, the different chapters. And it also helps keep me on track because I am very much a person who needs that structure. Some writers don't. Some writers do, and they don't like having that structure imposed on them because it doesn't give them the freedom to make changes. But I need to at least be able to keep the train on the tracks. Otherwise, I tend to, well, you know, go crazy, and I need that structure that a chapter outline provides. So I will often do that by hand before I start writing. And actually, the whiteboard things that I do, that generally comes near the end of the process, or at least near the end of draft one, because then I have the whole mess in front of me, and I need to make it look, you know, need to be able to break it down and see the pattern. So that's when I do that. But those are the things, along with just tons of research. I love to do research, and that is always very helpful for me, even if I have things that I don't use. Spending the time doing a lot of research helps me a lot. But those are the tools that I use that have been helpful for me.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, it's always nice to have to hear what other people like to use and have in their toolbox, because you never know what kind of tools you've been missing all along, and then you hear it and you're like, that's exactly what I needed. I should have been doing that from the get-go. So yeah, thank you. And thank you for being here to talk to me about storytelling, to talk to me about your new book, The Fallbacks Bound for Ruin. I kind of wanted to use this last question here to just kind of throw you the microphone and give you the opportunity to talk about anything that perhaps I didn't ask you that you've been wanting to say with regards to storytelling, with regards to your new book, with regards to the intersection between storytelling in the tabletop medium and in the, you know, in the author, in your profession as an author, and how those things connect. So I'll pass the microphone over to you, and then when you're done, feel free to also let people know where they can buy the book, where they can follow you on social media, and all of that good stuff as well.
Pressure here. Gotta keep all that straight. Well, as far as the book, you can get it wherever books are sold, whether it's Amazon, Barnes and Noble, your local independent bookstore. My local independent bookstore is Hartfield Books. You can order through, if you want to support them, one of my favorites, through bookshop.org. You can get the book there. I'm currently at work on the sequel, A New Adventure for the Fallbacks, right now. And as far as the intersection between tabletop games and writing or anything of that nature, I think the only thing that I would say on that topic is if you are a person who wants to take the plunge and write a story, if you are a person who wants to take the plunge and be a game master, do it. Don't wait. Don't be scared. Like I said, you'll do a better job than you think. and your players will, if you find a group of players that you care about and they care about you, they'll follow you anywhere. They'll follow you down the rabbit hole. Just do it. Just come on in. The water's fine.
Yeah. That's fantastic advice. I definitely echo that. I think people have a tendency to over-prepare when it comes to stuff like this, right? They want to have the perfect first draft, or they want to have the perfect circumstances that surround them starting the game that they've been wanting to run. So definitely,
yeah,
jump into the deep end. You'll be okay.
Such thing as the perfect game, the perfect story, the perfect draft doesn't exist. Just go out and create something messy and wonderful, because the world needs it. We need it. Trust me. So that's
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you, Jaylee. And as far as where people can find you and follow you, do you have like a website or a socials page that?
JaylieeJohnson.com. That's where you can find all my socials, all my info, all the info on the books. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So I'll make sure to have all of that stuff linked up in the description of today's show as well. So you just, open the show notes up. It'll be there. If you're listening on YouTube into the gobbledygook, you'll find what you need to find the Fallbacks Bound for Ruin, or to follow Jaylee, and be prepared for the next novel to come out. But so it's been a pleasure. Thank you for being here to talk to me about storytelling. It's been great.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. For those of you listening who want to reach out to me, you know how to do that. That's at role_play_chat on all socials. Or if you don't want to be subjected to a character limit, that's contact@roleplaychat@gmail.com. I'll see you all next time, and let's call it a chat. And lastly, if you wanted to support the show, there's a number of ways you can do that with or without spending money. You could support the show for free by spreading the word with your friends, sharing links about the show, and following me on socials. That's @role_play_chat on all socials. Or you can support the show financially by purchasing things with my affiliate links that you can find in the show notes of today's episode or all other episodes of the show. Or you can sign up to the Patreon, where you get access to shoutouts, as well as extended episodes, about 15-20 minutes of episodes that are only for Patreon subscribers. And as always, a big thank you to the Patreon supporters of Roleplay Chat. Thank you to DeMille's Wondrous Works and Jason over at Shadowmane. And last but not least, I wanted to thank Alex and Chase over at Puckabard for allowing me to use their music in the intro and outro for Roleplay Chat. Thanks, everybody, and have a good one. See you next time.